Well, it's clear now that we've worked our way through the COVID-induced recession and the resultant lull in our property markets has now turned and the markets are on the move again. And property predictions are coming thick and fast. One is that there's an elephant in the room that most aren't aware of, and that was made by property researcher John Lindemann, and I'm going to ask him what he means by that. But beforehand, I'm going to give you the answer that I gave to a journalist who recently asked me, why are property values going up at the moment when wages aren't going up and when unemployment's still high? I think you're going to get some insights from that answer so that you can hear what's ahead for our property markets and you can make your own plans as well. And of course, I'm going to share with you my regular mindset message. So welcome to today's episode of the Michael Yardney Podcast.
Welcome to the Michael Yardney Podcast, where twice each week you will learn a number of new ideas regarding success, property investment, and money in around 30 minutes. Our show is brought to you by Metropole, who specialize in helping you grow, protect, and pass on your wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. Now, here's your host, Michael Yardney, Australia's authority in wealth creation through property, who has been voted one of Australia's top 50 most influential thought leaders.
Before I have my chat with John Lindemann, I want to share with you a question that was asked to me by a media journalist asking why are house prices rising when wage growth is low and when unemployment is still high. Now, just to make things clear, this is not the same question as why are house prices so resilient? Why haven't they dropped much during the downturn, during the coronavirus-induced recession? The answer to that one's easy. House prices are never as volatile as the share market. Stocks go up and down quickly, but this time round, government intervention to support jobs and the economy and the provision of mortgage deferrals from the banks for homeowners and investors, well, that meant that there were very few property owners who felt mortgage stress. And in Australia, we had minimal, if any, distressed sales. So house prices remained resilient during the downturn. But the big question I'd like to discuss with you today is a different one. This question asked to me by the media, why are house prices still increasing in some locations? Now, the latest CoreLogic figures show that median house prices have increased in every capital city around Australia recently, but that doesn't reflect the strength of certain segments of the market, in particular the higher end properties, which have increased in value considerably. Well, my answer to the journalist was simple. Swelling disposable incomes at a time of falling interest rates and therefore lower property holding costs have left many borrowers much better off than they would have been a year ago. And we know that property is a game of finance, and if credit is easy and if holding costs are low, property values go up. Now, just like the health consequences of coronavirus didn't affect us all equally, with some groups in the community more vulnerable than others, with the health consequences, similarly, the COVID economic impact and the resultant recession hasn't affected us all equally either. You've heard me say it before on this podcast, we're all in the same ocean, but we were not in the same boat. Unfortunately, unemployment has risen, but the job losses have been disproportionately high amongst the lower income earners, amongst casual workers, and a lot of people lost their second job. Many of these people weren't typical homeowners, they're more likely to have been tenants. This meant our rental market suffered this year, with vacancies particularly high in the inner city apartment markets. Interestingly, vacancies for houses have been low. The demand for houses have been strong. But as I was getting at, vacancies in the rental markets have suffered. But on the other hand, around 90% of Australians still have a job, and many of them are better off financially with more disposable income than they've had for a long time, even if their wages haven't gone up. And if you add to that, in the last month or so, many workers will have seen their pay packets go up because of the newly introduced tax cuts. According to the latest credit and charge card data released by the Reserve Bank, Australians have wiped a staggering $7.3 billion off their personal credit card debt this year. At the same time Australians are drowning in cash, they've stashed more cash in their bank accounts than for a long, long time. Household deposits in financial institutions are up almost 12% over the year. In other words, we've amassed close to $100 billion in savings as a buffer against COVID. In September alone, $16.5 billion flowed into bank deposits. What all this means is that Australians have had more disposable income and they've put it aside just in case the worst came to worst. Fortunately, that didn't happen. And now Australians are seeing this as a great time to buy property. There's a significant group of Australians who've got secure income, secure employment, and they're in the position to take advantage of the current low interest rates. You would have heard in my recent podcast or on the Property Update blog how the respondents to this year's annual Property Investment Sentiment Survey saw this as the best time to invest in property for a long time. In fact, this year, 74% of respondents to my annual survey believed it's a good time to invest. And this is up significantly from 68% last year. And remember, this time last year, we were feeling good about property. 52% thought it was a good time to invest in property in 2018, 59% in 2017. I guess what I'm saying is more Australians than ever are feeling it's a good time to get into the property market. And 24% of the respondents said they were planning to buy a new home in 2021. That's up 20% from last year. Now, I can understand why many Australians squirrel their money away during the uncertain times of the COVID-19 pandemic. But now that it's clear that we're over the worst of the health issues, and now that we're working our way out of the recession, what's the use of having money in the bank earning, I don't know, 1% or 2% interest? Owner-occupiers are back in the market in force. They're driving up property prices. And I'm already noticing a sense of FOMO, that fear of missing out on the ground, particularly in some segments of the property market. Many established homeowners are looking to upgrade or downgrade their home at a time when their holding costs, their interest and holding costs, are going to be lowest they've ever been. And at the same time, first home buyers are back in the market. They're back with a vengeance, spurred on by the various grants and incentives, but also by the fact that first home owners don't actually have a trade-in to bring into the market like established home buyers do, and rising prices are going to leave them behind unless they take action. Now, a number of reports from the various institutions have shown that the average holding cost of a property has dropped considerably. This is another reason to answer that question of why a home value's rising despite wages not going up. It's because those who can afford to can actually get a home with a lower percentage of their earnings. It's been suggested by CanStar recently that to buy the average home on average income in Australia will only take 14% of earnings to be able to afford your home mortgage, compared to 21% of your earnings in 2012, 20% of your earnings in 2015. That huge drop in interest rate has made a big, big difference to the average Australian's mortgage costs. Anyway, you know the old saying, no one rings a bell at the bottom of the property market. But I believe when you look back next year, when you look back at this year, you're going to find that in October 2020, Australia's property markets turned the corner and we entered the beginning of a new property cycle. Remember, the recession we experienced was caused by a health crisis, not a fundamental economic issue with our economy, and our property markets were put on pause. But there was underlying strong demand at the beginning of this year when they were put on pause. Fortunately, we've overcome the health issues better than most countries in the world. And fortunately, our recession was shorter and sharper than most predicted. Now all credible economists agree that our property markets are going to enjoy a period of strong capital growth. I guess what the economists aren't agreeing on currently is how strong the markets will be, because unfortunately we've still got some economic headwinds to contend with. So putting all this into perspective, if you've got a secure job, if you've got security of income and you're looking to upgrade your home or downgrade your home if you're a baby boomer and the family's moved out, or particularly if you're looking at getting involved in property investment, this is a great time and it's probably the best time for a long time to get into the markets. Sure, a better time would have been 6 months ago when everyone was worrying about COVID and property values dropped, but our buyer's agents on the ground in the big capital cities are finding that there aren't any bargains in the investment grade markets, but currently there are home buyers and investors out looking for good stock. There's a flight to quality. A-grade properties, investment grade homes are selling well, are selling quickly. But when you look back at a year's time, you're going to think, hey, that was a good price. So if you're serious about getting into the property markets, you need more than a buyer's agent to help you because they've got a vested interest. Many buyer's agents, they're only going to buy in their patch. You're going to need more than the property strategist because in the challenging times ahead, and we have got challenges ahead, I believe you're going to need a more holistic approach. And I'm proud to say that's what my team at Metropole provide. Why not go and have a look at metropole.com.au and you'll understand how we have wealth advisory, financial planning, buyer's agency, property management, renovations, development. But it all starts with putting a plan together so that it's a strategic approach. We treat your property investment like a business. Go to metropole.com.au. I look forward to being part of your wealth creation journey. As we work our way out of the COVID-induced recession and the resultant lull in our property markets, property predictions keep coming. And while most of them have turned positive now, there are still some negative nullies out there. However, one respected researcher believes there's an elephant in the room that many people just haven't been paying attention to, and that happens to be John Lindemann. Oh, look, just to make things clear, John isn't the elephant. He's that widely respected Australian property market analyst. John's had over a decade of experience researching the nature and dynamics of the various asset classes. He's worked with some very large data houses, and he's a regular contributor to Property Update, to your investment property magazine, and a regular guest on this podcast. So welcome, John.
Hello, Michael, and hello, everyone. It's great to be here.
Now, John, it's been an interesting year and we're almost at the end of it. In one of your recent blogs on our website and on your website, you suggested there's an elephant about to make its presence felt in the property market. You said it's a potentially significant game changer. So what is it? What are you talking about?
What I'm talking about, Michael, is the interstate movement of people between one state or territory and the other. And the reason I call it it's an elephant in the property market is because it's largely hidden. When we look at the stats, we look at the net interstate migration figures, not the total number of people moving. So what it does is it hides the effect it has in the market.
So what you're actually saying is there are really twice as many people moving if you're taking the net figure. In other words, there's people moving in, people moving out, and the net figure is zero, but that's actually not the case when you're looking at the number of property transactions that have to occur.
That's right. And the significance of this is that the people moving in are likely to be different to the people moving out. For example, in Canberra, 10% of Canberra's population move in or out of the territory every year. But the net migration is zero because 22,000 come in and another 22,000 leave. That wouldn't make any real difference if it was the same type of people, but it isn't, because what happens in Canberra is that the arrivals are young professionals on government contracts. So what they tend to do is to rent units, whereas the 22,000 leaving, most of those are people who have been in the public service or employment in Canberra all their lives, and they're moving away to retire. So they're selling family homes and moving to places like Batemans Bay on the coast. And so it's a completely different demographic, and that has a tremendous impact on the Canberra housing market.
So clearly in the last little while, movements hasn't been as much, borders are being closed, and people are being a bit cautious about moving. It's stressful enough where you are rather than having the stress of moving. What do you see happening moving forward?
What I see happening is that at the moment we've had a situation where the state borders have been closed and they're all gradually have been reopened or will be reopened very, very shortly. And that means that people can start to move around between states once again. So we've had this sort of backlog of people wanting to move, not being able to. So younger people maybe moving from Perth or Adelaide to the East Coast haven't been able to do that. Older people wanting to move to retirement areas in other states haven't been able to, but now suddenly they're all going to start moving.
Well, it's interesting because just recently we did our annual survey of property investor sentiment where 1,500 respondents told us what they were planning to do. One of the questions I asked this year, John, was, are you planning to move because of COVID? And interestingly, and I think not surprisingly, 90% of people said they're not going to move. But of those 10% who said they were going to move, the majority were actually thinking about moving to Queensland as opposed to tree change or regional Australia. But Queensland's always been a recipient of interstate migration, hasn't it?
It has, for different reasons at different times. There was a time when Queensland was the only state that didn't have death duties on estates, and so a lot of older people moved there so they wouldn't have to pass, you know, the tax on to their kids. When we had mining booms, a lot of younger people moved because of the great employment opportunities. But right now I can see a lot of people thinking about moving because the housing market is very affordable there. There's a lot of sort of different industries, you know, there's a great mix of employment opportunities. And I think another important thing is that now we've got 4 years of political stability in Brisbane, you know, whether we were in favour of the result or not. Nevertheless, Anastasia is going to be premier there for 4 years. So I think all of that counts in Queensland's favour.
Well, Queensland didn't have the big downturn during 2020 that some of the other states had, but it didn't have the big upturn beforehand. But it seems like a lot of things are pointing to it being Brisbane and Southeast Queensland's turn in the sun now. They've got a more diversified economy. They've got a lot of infrastructure happening, and it's a pretty good place to live, and it's quite cheap, isn't it?
It is very affordable, even in Brisbane itself. I think when you look at the upper priced areas of Brisbane, they still really haven't got over the effects of the flood that occurred there. Those areas near the rivers are still, you know, much lower priced than similar types of areas in other capital cities. And when you look historically at the price relationship, it's quite interesting because there have been times when Brisbane's median house price has been almost the same as Sydney, and at the moment it's about half that of Sydney. So you think, well, either Brisbane's going to go up or Sydney's going to go down, one of the two. And I know what I'd be betting on.
Well, I don't think Sydney's going to go down. Interestingly, wages are probably a little bit higher in Sydney also, but there's no doubt that properties are more affordable in Brisbane. It's a different lifestyle, and that's good. Currently, John, there's a lot of media focus on housing demand and on prices, but I'd like to also have a look at the other side of the equation, the supply side of the equation, because I know from your research you look carefully at the supply and demand factors. I think you believe that that's probably one of the most important factors in determining which way property prices are going to head.
I think, yeah, you've got to look at both sides of the equation. And unfortunately, developers have had a pretty bad rap. You know, we've had a lot of talk about unsafe, high-density apartments, especially in Sydney, the fact that they encourage speculative investment. But when you look at our towns and cities, most of the attractive sort of development and redevelopment and gentrification of areas that's occurred has been because of property development. So there is a very good side to it, and it's a much maligned part of the property market, which I think doesn't deserve that.
Well, there's no doubt that there have been some poorly built developments, and there have been others that have been aimed at overseas investors who had different ideas in mind to what maybe local homeowners would have. But now with the restriction of how many foreign investors there are coming into the country, and at the same time how many properties you can sell in any development to foreign investors, I can see that the next round of development, which unfortunately is going to have quite a lag behind it, but the next round of development is going to be better class of apartments, but also it's going to end up being much more expensive, isn't it?
I think we're seeing a trend in Australia that more and more people want to live in units, and whereas traditionally about 80% of units were owned by investors, we've seen recent high-rise developments of high quality which have been marketed to owner-occupiers who want to, you know, live in a unit that's in a ideally located area that's high quality, easy to maintain, and all the facilities that are there. You know, some of these big apartment blocks have got gymnasiums and pools and barbecue areas, and they're actually quite well located as well. So I think it's a change that's been occurring.
Well, developers are going to have to build a different standard of dwelling for owner-occupiers. And if they do that, I can see that there's going to be a lot of demand from downsizers, not for those pokey little apartments, but for something that's in the inner and middle ring suburbs of our capital cities, maybe more so than in the CBD if you're talking about downsizers, because they're going to want to still go to the same shops, the same hairdresser, the same dentist, but they're not going to want something as small and pokey. But if that's the case and we're building for the right the right sort of stock for the right sort of people, that's only going to be good, because we've got to put this huge growing population somewhere. Sydney's going to be 8 million people in not too long a time, much the same as Melbourne. And Australia's got a business plan of having, 50 million people over the next 40 years or so. We've got to put them somewhere.
That's right. And when we've looked back at what's happened in the past, when borders have been closed, what's happened to Australia's population? Now, the last time that happened was during the First and Second World Wars, because the borders were closed purely because of the war. It was unsafe to get on a boat and travel. So our population growth fell right back. But once those conflicts were over, our population grew by record levels. We had well over 2%, up to 2.5% annual growth immediately after the First and the Second World Wars. And a lot of those were people who came here from other countries to escape all the conflict and the ravages that the war had caused. So I think we're going to see a very similar thing occurring, and that is people coming here from pandemic-ravaged Europe and America and escaping to what they see as a safe haven, where there's virtually we seem to have beaten the pandemic here, and our economy is back in growth. So this is the place to be.
Well, you can see it happening from Hong Kong as well. And people are wondering, is that the right thing? Are these people going to take Australian jobs? But it's been shown over and over again that every immigrant, not those who are maybe at school age or the very old ones who need nursing care, but those who are in working age, they create more jobs than they take, and they need to buy televisions and refrigerators and carpets. They need accommodation. So it's one good way of the government increasing our GDP, increasing our economy by having more people spending.
That's right. It has been proven that that's the case. And our biggest economic booms have been during such times. And, of course, the increase in population has led to a rise in housing demand, and so we get this rise in demand. Now, the problem with that, Michael, is, of course, the developers tend to lag behind the demand.
Well, it's a long time between when you first come up with the concept of high-rise development and the time it's completed. So if you want to build in bulk, you've really only got two choices: on the outskirts of the city where you build new estates, or inside where you're building, right in the middle where you're building those high-rise towers. And in both cases, there's quite a long period of getting approval, getting finance, making the sales, doing the construction, and then getting people in. I guess that's why we have the boom and bust cycle, John, or one of the reasons.
Yes, it's got a lot to do with it. I had a good look at what happened on the Gold Coast during the last boom and after that. Now, the Gold Coast high-rise unit market, there was tremendous demand in the early leading sort of from 2003 up to 2006-07, and that was mainly overseas buyers who were buying off the plan units, and the demand just went through the roof. And, of course, developers started selling and pre-selling units off the plan to these overseas investors. Now, as long as the dynamics don't change, there's no problem with that. But of course, what happened in 2008 was the global financial crisis, and that meant that the demand for units from overseas investors completely collapsed. And of course, all these units still had to be built, but there was no longer any demand for them. And so what we saw was unit prices fall on the Gold Coast in 2008, 9 and 10 by around 40 to 50%. It was quite one of the worst crashes we've had in a major market. Now, what happens with developers is after they experience something like that, they're very, very careful about going into such a market again. So it's really only been in the last few years with the opening of the G-Link, the light rail that's going all the way. Down, yeah, I mean, that's increasing demand. Of course, the Commonwealth Games in 2018. So the whole market is now building up. Demand is increasing dramatically, but the development side has yet to catch up to that.
So that's not just in the Gold Coast, but there's actually very few cranes in the other capital cities at the moment. So that extra supply will be slowly soaked up, and every boom sets the tide for the next downturn. Just as at the moment, the challenges we've had is setting the scene for the next property upturn. And I know in our private chats, you were suggesting that we're likely to see some really good times ahead next year in 2021.
I think so, especially once the international borders are open. But even before then, I think you can do well if you invest in areas that don't rely on housing demand from overseas arrivals. Other areas will do very well. And then, of course, once the international borders are opened, I think we're going to see a massive rise in housing demand and economic growth. And I think we'll be looking ahead and then looking back in the future and say that was a wonderful time to invest in property.
Well, you and I have been around long enough to remember how difficult it felt during the global financial crisis. We had the perspective, already being older than some of the others, to say, no, it's actually not that bad. This is a good time to get in, just like it was in the 1990s downturn as well. So I agree with you. People are going to look back and we'll have mixed recollections of 2020, but those who've actually set themselves up, those who had the foresight to have a long-term view, are going to do well. It's the old saying that Warren Buffett said, isn't it? Be fearful when others are greedy and greedy when others are fearful.
That's right. It's never been a more apt saying than that right now.
Sure. So there's a couple of trends to watch out for. Once the borders open, once life gets more normal, there's going to be the interstate migration that's going to create the demand for certain sorts of properties. Once the international borders open, which is going to be a lot longer, of course, that means there's going to be a demand from immigrants, from students, and that's also, let's hope the tourists all come back as well and help our economy. So, John, thanks for those thoughts. It'll be interesting to see how they all transpire. Look forward to catching up with you and having a chat again real soon.
Thanks, Michael. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Now here's Michael's mindset message. Remember, a change in your thinking will lead to a change in your life.
We're at the beginning of a new year, and you're probably evaluating how things went last year, and you've probably made a number of resolutions for the coming year. So in today's mindset message, I'd like to talk with you about how you're going to measure your success. Remember, last year, lots of the ideas you had at the beginning of the year were probably blown out of the water because of COVID. But 2021 is going to be a much better year, isn't it? So what are your rules for success? If you're like most people, you're going to have some rules either in your head or possibly written down. Now, I remember many, many years ago, I went to a retreat on the Sunshine Coast where I set the plans for the next stage of my life to build the Metropole Group of companies to become what they are today. I pictured what I'd need to do to become Australia's leading expert in wealth creation through property. I set myself some audacious goals. I wanted to become a published author. Remember, that was many years ago, before I'd written nine books now. I wanted offices in the three big capital cities. Remember, this is when I was still working from home with Pam. I wanted 100,000 subscribers to my newsletter database. At that time, I didn't have a newsletter. Last year, over 2.5 million unique people read my newsletter. I wanted to be in the media. This was before I had regular segments on radio and podcasts and blogs. I'd set myself up a whole heap of criteria to measure my success. But as I grew my business, as I grew personally, I had doubts about my success because I didn't fulfill all of those criteria straight away. At times, I didn't feel the success I should be feeling. Not for the levels of achievement that I'd already achieved. At times I felt doubt. I felt fear. I felt a little bit insecure. Can you relate to that? But then again, that was many years ago. And my business coach at the time, and I've always had business coaches and they've helped me through these challenges, my business coach at the time asked me to do an audit of my own personal rules of success. And they're extremely high. I couldn't go from being unknown in the real estate community to being the most respected expert straight away. Sure, I'm there now, about 25 years later. I couldn't build a database of hundreds of thousands of subscribers in a few years. But as I said, I've achieved much, much more than that now. I couldn't write one or two books and now nine books and get in the media straight away. but I've achieved that now. However, what I'm trying to say is at the time I set myself some audacious goals that were unrealistic for me. And the biggest challenge I had was that I used the word and to connect my goals. I had to achieve this and that and that. So if any one of my goals weren't achieved, as unrealistic as some of those goals were, I didn't feel successful. So the big breakthrough I had, and I'd like to share that with you today, is I changed my rules for success. The first thing I did was take away the word and. It became or. I was able to feel proud. I was able to feel successful if I achieved any of my goals. The next thing I did was set up a whole lot of little rules of success rather than just aiming for the big final goal, which meant that any small victory I made along the way made me feel better, made me feel successful. So think about your journey in life as we enter a new year, whether it's in property, in business, in your personal life. What rules have you set yourself to judge your success? Sometimes it'll be clear to you, sometimes they're unconscious. So what are the crazy, silly, outrageous rules of success that you've set yourself that are causing you frustration? Take the time to evaluate them, to reassess them, to reset them, and make this a great year. We covered a lot in today's show, and hopefully now you've got some more direction about what's ahead for our property markets as we're moving into the beginning of a new cycle. If you got some benefit from it, I'd really appreciate it if you helped others get more insight, become more financially fluent. That's the purpose of me putting this podcast together, to stop people making the common mistakes they make with their money, with their success, and with property. So tell somebody about the show. There's a share button on every podcast app, or tell the world by leaving a review on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you listen to this. And if I read it out, as I'm about to for Dorothy 457, I'm going to say thank you by gifting you one of my books. Now, Dorothy, if you email me, michael@metropole.com.au, I'd love to gift you a book. Dorothy left a 5-star review, and hey, they all seem to be, so I really appreciate that. But she said, I just wanted to reach out and say thank you to you and your wonderful guests. All the great information you give me twice a week on your podcast is fantastic. It's made me think very differently about property, and I now understand why I haven't done things right in the first part of my journey, but I'm sure I'm going to do things right now with your guidance. Thanks, Michael. Well, thank you for those kind words, Dorothy. And yes, there are lots of myths and misconceptions about property. I guess that's one of the purposes of this podcast, to help correct those. So I'll be back twice a week with the regular Michael Yardney podcast. But in between, you can catch me on social media. Just look for Michael Yardney, or why not join our closed property update Facebook group, where you get exclusive information on a regular basis. Well, at least before everyone else does. So just look for the property update group on Facebook. Look forward to catching up with you again real soon. In the meantime, have a great week. Make it a great week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Michael Yardney Podcast, which was brought to you by Metropole, who help their clients grow, protect, and pass on their wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. If you like what you heard and don't already subscribe, you'll find us on iTunes or on your favorite Android app as the Michael Yardney Podcast. Watch out for our next show, which comes to you twice a week, and you'll learn some new ideas about property investment, success, and money in around 30 minutes. To get more of Michael's thoughts, go across to www.propertyupdate.com.au and sign up for his daily morning briefing, and you'll hear from not only Michael, but a group of leading property success and money experts. And just a reminder that the information you heard in this show today is general educational advice and not specific investment advice, as we don't know your personal circumstances. If you're looking for specific advice, why not ask the team at Metropole to help you?